You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of The Price of Infamy by Michelle Ruiz. No one called it trauma back then. Shortly after the shooting, a school psychologist called Jesse out of class. There were already whispers in the hall. Jesse didn't trust the counselor, not with reporters in her bushes and a neighbor at the Biltmore Beach Club, where she swam the butterfly, selling intel. Sitting, defiant, in the office, Jesse remembers being told that she didn't have to come back, as long as no one saw her slipping. She committed to perfection right there. Even though I was unraveling, she tells me, I was keeping it together the best I could. At home, Mary Jo modeled stoicism. She was in chronic pain, increasingly reliant on prescription pills, while contending with a crush of lawyers and district attorneys. When Jesse and Paul were around, Mommy was fine. Mary Jo imitates her younger self. Everything's fine. Sometimes the Butterfucos made a game of the media fracas, flicking their lights while news crews filmed live shots outside. Mary Jo, at 70, her formerly feathered blonde hair cut into a bob, is sitting at the dining table of the modest blue house she shares with Jesse. It's as pristine as ever, with hanging plants and a curio cabinet filled with tiny Swarovski crystal frogs and butterflies. She suffers complications like chronic fatigue, but also hits the gym daily. Jesse learned black humor from Mary Jo, who titled her 2009 memoir, Getting It Through My Thick Skull, sharing her belief that her by-then ex-husband was, in fact, a sociopath. She calls Jesse and me girls, even though we're older now than she was in 1992. Back then, Mary Jo says, she wanted to protect her kids from her suffering. They were the reason that I lived. They were the reason that I fought, she tells me. As she lay on the ground that May day, the explosion reverberating in her head, she had a single thought. Get up, Mary Jo. The kids are coming home from school. In the true crime realm, Mary Jo is an anomaly. Everyone else is dead in these stories, Jesse says, with characteristic bluntness. Mary Jo would later call herself a living murder victim, but staying with Joey made her an imperfect one. Weeks after our visit, Jesse texted me an image of Mary Jo's face, illustrated on a vintage Major League Scandal trading card. It notes she was nearly traded to the Angels in 1992. Among her listed weaknesses, gullible. Jesse says her parents were booked on Donahue in 1992, under the guise of telling their side of the story, only for Mary Jo to be ambushed by a live audience. I found myself, which now I realize was so wrong, defending him, Mary Jo tells me of her ex. That's a story unto itself, but the family believed Joey over Fisher, whom a sentencing judge likened to a wild animal stalking its prey. I've heard more than one wife claim they would have divorced Joey from the hospital bed. And I wonder about this feminine urge to judge a mother who'd been left to die on her front steps. It's been long enough that the blowback makes Mary Jo laugh. Where was I supposed to go? She croaks. I could barely breathe. For Jesse, it was a weird sandwich being the daughter of a victim and soon a perpetrator. In October 1993, Joey confessed to the relationship with Fisher that he'd long denied. In the eyes of the law, the so-called affair turned out to be criminal. Fisher wasn't a lover, but a child when the relationship began, a year shy of the age of consent in New York in 1991. Joey was arrested and indicted on 19 counts, including statutory rape and sodomy. I vaguely recall leafing through Newsday, asking my parents what the latter charge meant. As Jessie went to fourth grade, her dad reported to Nassau County Correctional Facility for a six-month sentence. I didn't really have much of a mom anymore, Jessie says. Now her dad, the fun dad, who took us for two fast rides on his speedboat, Double Trouble, emblazoned with twin dice, was gone too. Visiting Joey right before Christmas 1993 shook 10-year-old Jessie. Her father was incarcerated for a time alongside Colin Ferguson, who committed the 1993 Long Island Railroad massacre, and serial killer Joel Rifkin. Though Joey was famous on the beach for being able to rip a telephone book in half, Jessie worried, maybe they'd kill my dad too. She remembers getting letters and gifts from her father, including a handkerchief stenciled with a butterfly, a teddy bear, and her name in cursive. It hung on her bedroom wall for years, torturing her. I thought of my dad. I thought of the serial killers. I thought of how you just never know who a person truly is. In March 1994, Joey left jail in a Rolls Royce that took him to a 400-guest release party at Cafe Testarossa. Flashbulbs lit the parking lot. The cake was reportedly in the shape of Double Trouble. Like the Hollywood trip, it was splashy fun if you didn't think too hard about the reason. My mom was one of the few in their circle who declined to attend. The celebration proved short-lived. While visiting in Los Angeles in 1995, Joey was arrested again for soliciting an undercover police officer posing as a sex worker on Sunset Boulevard. It was a violation of his probation, for which he served another 78 days. A year later, the Butterfucos went west. There was nothing left for them on Long Island. Landing in California at 13, I was like Brittany Murphy in Clueless, Jessie says. Her last name loomed even larger in a new school. Are you friends with me because you think I'm funny, or because you want to say you went to Joey Buttafuoco's house? We drifted apart, though neither of us remembers the details. There was no social media, only letters and cross-country phone calls. Jessie kept her plates spinning. If she were to be known as Joey Buttafuoco's daughter, she'd single-handedly rehab the family name with her own glittering reputation. At El Camino Real High School, she was crowned prom queen, captained the basketball team, ran track, played Otto Annie in Oklahoma, sang in the elite choir, and won Best Personality and Most Talented. Her dizzying schedule left precious little time to think or truly connect. Everyone knew her, but no one cracked her hard candy shell. After everything, Jessie's parents separated in 2000. It had been the Buttafuocos against the world. Now, Jessie thought, I literally have nobody. She lived with Mary Jo in an apartment while Joey moved to Chatsworth, the porn capital of the world, Jessie says with cheerful disdain, citing a local production of The Sopranos. In the Chatsworth milieu, she says her jewelry was stolen, and she found herself at a group dinner with Ron Jeremy, who asked, "When are you going to be in my movies?" For Jessie, love and sex were too tinged with violence. She didn't date. The two times she tried, it raced like a ticker through her mind, "I can't trust you. Even if you think it's perfect, someone might come and murder me and stalk me in the bushes, or exploit me sexually and sell it to the Inquirer," she says. One guy was unbearably kind, but Jessie harbored a constant fears of dying. In a relationship with a man 20 years her senior, I was so codependent and so daddy broken, she recalls, and I changed. The Buttafuoco infamy never converted to fame. Joey and Mary Jo attended the Oscars in 1995, but Hollywood prospects dwindled from there. Among Joey's film credits, Guy in 2003's mafia movie Madness. They were ripe, however, for the reality TV boom of the early aughts, especially as money ran low. Joey signed on to spar with John Bobbitt on Celebrity Boxing in 2002. The latter was replaced by female wrestler Chyna. In 2006, Mary Jo, Joey, and Fisher taped a reunion sit-down. Mary Jo has called it an offer she couldn't refuse. The stunts went further in 2007, with Joey and Fisher filming a date for The Insider, kissing beneath an umbrella in New York like a deranged rom-com. He later said it wasn't real, but it broke Jesse's heart. The following year, a sex tape surfaced starring Joey and his second wife. Meanwhile, Joey's legal woes raged on. In December 2003, police rushed his house, arresting him in an insurance fraud sting collected to his California body shop. Home from UC Santa Barbara on holiday break, Jesse says she was held for 8 hours, with officers escorting her to the bathroom. Joey pleaded guilty to felony insurance fraud and was sentenced to a year in jail. By 2005, he'd been arrested again for having a gun at home, a violation of his parole. He pleaded no contest to illegally possessing ammunition and served 3 months of a one-year sentence. "You love this person," Jesse says, "but he was also effing ruining my life." Jesse's surname constantly betrayed her. "I'm not sure how many people have stood in a room, and when their last name is read out loud, every eye in the room swooshes toward you," she writes in her work-in-progress memoir. "It's like waiting to be punched in the face." Jesse considered changing her last name. Her mom has. She liked the sound of Jessica Barclay, emphasis on the second syllable, but says she lacked the cash to tackle the bureaucracy. Using her middle name, Louise, yielded more callbacks on job applications until she had to supply her ID. Googling Jesse's name returns pages of scandalousness, her digital legacy until the day I die. Hard as she has tried, she cannot escape herself. "To cope, the first thing I would do is grab a drink," Jesse says. From her teens on, alcohol worked like medicine, and eventually Jesse added weed, then cocaine. For more than a decade after college graduation, she ran a children's theater business, gravitating toward outsiders who, like her, found a home on stage. She kept performing, auditioning for The Voice. Her appearance never aired. Playing Jay Wow in Jersey Shoresical, a frickin' rock opera, a play created by her friend Daniel Francese, Damien from Mean Girls. Behind the scenes, though, Jesse floundered. She binge drank through her 20s and into her 30s, sipping wine from coffee mugs, downing a bottle or two a day of wine, vodka. It worked to numb her until it didn't. By the time Jesse turned 34, everything she'd stuffed down started seeping to the surface. Her body revolted, her nails folding, her cognition delayed when she tried to read. She scarcely ate and struggled to hold a pencil without shaking. Jesse tried quitting drinking and lasted 2 days, crying as she lifted wine to her lips. She didn't want to do it anymore, but she couldn't not. In her lowest rock-bottom moments, Jesse contemplated taking her own life, reciting a desperate prayer at night. "Dear God, please take me off of this planet. I don't want to be here anymore." 8 months sober through AA and therapy and still hopeless, Jesse entered an intensive outpatient mental health program. At 35, she had feelings homework, recognizing herself in worksheets on anxiety, depression, and PTSD. In some ways, she'd never matured past age 9. Trying to further understand her experience, Jesse earned a graduate psychology degree, a master's in healing at Pepperdine University. Working as a therapist, Jesse understood her patients' trauma on a personal level, but troubled teens, including some with violent ideations, hit too close to home. It was like I was dealing with Amy Fisher's all day, she says. Around that time, Jessie found what she'd been looking for, a rare doctoral program in media psychology at Fielding Graduate University in Santa Barbara. After a lifetime lumping herself in with the family joke, she was seeing herself anew. I'm effing really smart, she says, and I have something to say. The application practically wrote itself. This is who my parents are, she says, and this is why I want to change true crime. When I watch the news and I see a body under a tarp, I'm like, that's somebody's daughter. That's somebody's wife. Tanya Brown, the youngest sister of Nicole Brown Simpson and a friend of Jesse's, told me by phone. The morning after her sister's murder in 1994, while the world watched Wrapped on TV, here I am in the living room holding my mom's hand, and she's saying, that's my kid. I think about the culture-cracking case of Luigi Mangione, charged with murdering UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson, the thirsty tweets and Etsy merch, and immediate announcement of forthcoming documentaries. How, policy debates aside, most coverage centered the alleged murderer over the victim or his 16 and 19-year-old children. Jessie says she's been prodded by TV producers to read and reread scripted lines about the day her mother was shot, as if she were a voiceover actor. One unsubtly suggested she cry for drama's sake, but denying her experience didn't work. I tried that for 35 years, Jessie tells me. That's what almost killed me. She does want to tell her story on her own terms. Jessie is advocating for a more ethical true crime industry, one that consults victims and their families and shares streaming profits with them. Kennedy scion Jack Schlossberg has suggested that Ryan Murphy Productions, maker of FX's already divisive JFK Jr. series, donate to the JFK Presidential Library. With a recently launched consultancy, Mental Health Media Services, Jessie wants to normalize on-set mental health coordinators, akin to intimacy coordinators for sex scenes, to support subjects rehashing their trauma on camera. Maybe this is the real reason she didn't change her name, I think. Maybe she was meant to stay a Buttafuoco and find some power in it. One rock at a time, baby, Jessie calls over her shoulder. She leads the way in black leggings and hokas, balancing on stepping stones as we cross a sparkling stream at Malibu Creek State Park. It's a Bob Ross painting out here, with natural pools and sprays of yellow flowers and mountains in the distance that look like the Paramount logo. I imagine us clicking our heels. We're not in Massapequa anymore. Nature was never Jessie's thing. The sounds of birds only happened when I was coming down off a Coke bender, but she appreciates the simplicity now. That's why I haven't had most of my life, Jessie says. That's what I haven't had most of my life, Jessie says, looking for rocks. She's in a rock hunter's Facebook group, and it shows when she breaks out a hammer and chisel. Instead of drinking to cope, she smashes milky rocks looking for crystals within. Healing takes effort, and Jessie doesn't try to tie herself in a lacy bow. She drove here recently after one of those encounters, a bank teller eyeing her last name and trying to place it. She went to AA this morning. Later she'll head to work as a therapist at a treatment center for mental health and substance abuse. Though unconventional, she says living with her mom feels like making up for the years they lost after the shooting. Jessie cut ties with her dad 6 years ago. She thanked him for the good parts, the boat rides and the water balloon fights of her childhood, while prioritizing her own mental health. When he later questioned her critiques, she fired off a strongly worded email, a manifesto, really. Item 1, cheating on my mother and almost getting her killed. Every Father's Day, she posts Madonna ripping his picture to shreds. Weeks after our visit, Jesse's dad is pictured in an Instagram post citing James Brolin as the director of a mysterious project, a biopic, possibly entitled Joey. Jesse is still blindsided sometimes, like she was that night at Saturday Night Live. Back at her house, I listen in on her Zoom with two documentary producers who suggest she co-direct a project on her family scandal, but issue a satirically Hollywood caveat. Nothing will sell without a sick quorum, full participation from Joey, Mary Jo, and Fisher. When one of the producers casually suggests, "What if you interviewed Amy?" Jesse shoots her down with an unequivocal F no. "You're traumatizing me by just asking me that question," she snaps back. "She took a gun to my mother's head." Now here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis, Luca Guadagnino, the director of After the Hunt, on the benefits of solipsism and the very first cake he ever baked. What or who is the greatest love of your life? Cinema. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I'm too tall. What is your idea of perfect happiness, the end of stupidity in others? What is your greatest extravagance? Collecting art. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? Being romantic. What is your greatest fear? Human beings in positions of power. Which word or phrase do you most overuse? Adore. What is your greatest regret? I have no regrets. When and where were you happiest? In Palermo, at the age of 10, when I made my first pain genoise. Which historical figure do you most identify with? I wish I could identify with someone, but I am limited in the scope of things to my own perspective. Which living person do you most admire? Any doctor who gives their science and efforts in theaters of war, not embedded. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Coherence. On what occasion do you lie? I am incapable of lying. What is your current state of mind? Despair. What do you consider your greatest achievement? Making people better. What is your most treasured possession? My friendships. Where would you like to live? Where I live. What is your favorite occupation? Doing nothing. What is your most marked characteristic? Being frenetic. What do you most value in your friends? Being contradictory. Who are your favorite writers? E.M. Forster and Thomas Mann and Klaus Mann and Erica Mann and M. Gessen. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? The Prince in Snow White. What are your favorite names? Cosima, Giacomo. What is it that you most dislike? Coldness in others. How would you like to die? Without acknowledging it. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? A piece of gold, never to be found by the humans. What is your motto? I will always change my mind. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Luca Guadagnino. team's gambit. Many have tried to crack the notoriously tricky musical chess, but Nicholas Christopher, Leah Michelle, and Aaron Dwight might actually pull it off. Chris Murphy reports. Opening photograph by Mark Seliger. Pawn Stars. Photographed at Jefferson Market Garden in New York City. Sittings editor, Daniel Edley. Chess. A show about dueling grandmasters, one Russian and one American, facing off at the peak of the Cold War, has always been a confounding musical. Its score is filled with undeniable bangers, courtesy of ABBA's Bjorn Ulvaeus and Benny Andersson. Yet its original book by Tim Rice, who co-wrote the lyrics with Ulvaeus, was widely regarded as an incomprehensible mess. Theater luminaries from Michael Bennett to Trevor Nunn have sought to crack the story, all to no avail. When Chess opened at New York's Imperial Theater in the spring of 1988, it earned scathing reviews and closed just 2 months later. It hasn't been on Broadway since. Then, Danny Strong, the Gilmore Girls star turned Emmy-winning screenwriter, had a wild idea. "I want to fix Chess, and I want you to direct it," he told Michael Meyer one night. Meyer, the Tony-winning director, who has helmed canonical Broadway productions of Thoroughly Modern Millie, Spring Awakening, and Hedwig and the Angry Inch, was intrigued. "I woke up the next morning, and there was an email from Michael saying, 'I'm in,'" says Strong. "They're finally ready to bring their vision of Chess to Broadway. With Ulvaeus's, Andersson's, and Rice's blessing, Strong and Meyer have retooled the musical for an all-star cast featuring Nicholas Christopher, Tony winner Aaron Dwight, and Glee star Leah Michelle. Thanks to Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin's frenemyship, the project suddenly feels more timely than it has since the Berlin Wall came crashing down. Current American-Russian relations are so reminiscent of early Cold War ideology," says Meyer. "The stakes are so resonant to what we're living through right now," agrees Strong. "The fear and emotion and unpredictability. I think that there are a lot of people that are going to understand the political importance of our show and the state of our world right now," Michelle adds. "I don't like to be a part of anything that doesn't have something to say. This Chess stands alone. We really are making our own thing. The story that we're doing isn't based on any previous version," says Meyer. At the same time, the creative team had to make their fresh story fit within the parameters set by the show's indelible score. "There will, of course, be similarities. They're baked into the DNA of the material," says Meyer. "But in this and Strong's version, the characters have different relationships to each other and to their countries." Meyer and Strong also leaned into the Cold War aspect, injecting the show's fictional plot with actual historical events. To further clarify a convoluted narrative, they turned an ancillary character called the Arbiter into an MC of sorts, a figure akin to Che, the narrator of Evita, who can guide the audience through the revamped story while also referencing the current political climate. The Chess revival's timing is uncanny. Weeks before rehearsals began, Trump flew to Alaska for a summit with Putin, potentially a step toward ending the war in Ukraine. It was the two world leaders' first in-person meeting since 2019. "We're perhaps living through a second Cold War between these nations," says Strong. Dwight puts it another, bleaker way. "We might be closer to the moment of somebody pushing that button than people thought they were in the early 80s. Still, Strong and Meyer's vision couldn't come to life until they found performers with the chops to pull off both demanding vocals and a dramatic central love triangle. Hearing the final trio sing together is jaw-droppingly delicious," Meyer teases. "Their chemistry is great." Christopher stars as chess champion Anatoly the Russian Sergeyevsky. As Meyer says, the versatile Christopher can do anything. He's performed roles from Seymour in Little Shop of Horrors to Sweeney Todd. A Broadway vet with 5 shows under his belt, the Bermuda-born, Boston-raised Christopher has been preparing by immersing himself in Russian culture. I have a Russian friend. He was born in the Soviet Union, and he came to America when he was like 13 years old, the actor says. He's been introducing me to his family. He's telling me different sayings in Russian. We got drunk on vodka together. A lot of our conversation I can't remember. At least one colonel stuck with Christopher. He told me, to understand Russia is to know that you can never understand Russia. I was like, what does that mean? He's like, I don't know, but it's Russian. Christopher is keenly aware of the ways in which his own identity informs the character. At the end of Act One, Anatoly sings the soaring anthem about his complex love for his homeland, a feeling Christopher can't help but relate to. It's complicated, right? He says, to have such a deep-rooted love for where you come from, yet does where you come from have the love for you back? Christopher faces off against Veidt's American chess master, whose name, for real, is Freddie Trumper. How did Rice know to call the character that? He's the Nostradamus of the 80s, says Veidt. A Tony winner for originating the role of Christian in Moulin Rouge, Veidt got the part after Michelle met with her friend Jonathan Groff, while the project was still in development. I was like, if they don't find a good Freddie, we cannot do this show. And he said, well, then you have to call Aaron Veidt, she recalls. You know what I did? I called Aaron Veidt. It's one of the most demanding roles of Veidt's career. Freddie, the American, is an MF to seeing, says Meyer, but Veidt is more than up for it. I like a challenge, he says. People that know the show have such a close tie to the music, he continues. When you work on that a little bit as an actor, sometimes it's your job to get out of the way, let the music do its thing. Veidt's role is loosely based on real-life American prodigy Bobby Fischer, who defeated a Russian opponent at the World Championship in 1972, making him the first American ever to win the title. His triumph was short-lived. Fischer eventually descended into paranoia and became a recluse. Bobby Fischer thought that the Russians were spying on him, and they all made him seem like he was crazy. But then, of course, they were spying on him. So we have a little bit of that in this show, says Veidt. Freddie might be crazy, but the things they are calling him crazy for are actually true. It's really an interesting acting piece, because it's all about mental health. Next photo, Game On, Chess on Broadway in 1988. As far as actual chess goes, the 3 stars have varying levels of experience. Christopher is planning a trip to Brighton Beach to play chess with some Russians. Veidt learned the game from his father, but hasn't played in years. I have a couple buddies who play on chess.com, serious players, he says. They've been giving him helpful pointers offline, but he's not ready to take his talents to the World Wide Web just yet. Oh, I don't want to go on and have this terrible rating, he says. I'm hoping to make a splash on chess.com. Michelle, meanwhile, is hitting the books to up her own chess game. I did buy chess for dummies for me and Aaron, she says. She also has her own personal tutor. Jonathan Groff has been giving me some private lessons. Chess will be something of a homecoming for Michelle, bringing her back to the Imperial, where she began her Broadway career as a child in Les Miserables almost 30 years ago, and reuniting her with Meyer, who directed her in both Spring Awakening and her triumphant onstage comeback vehicle, Funny Girl. Working on the latter was such a profound thrill, says Meyer. Right after she opened, we started saying, okay, what are we going to do next? She plays Florence Vassy, a brilliant chess strategist caught between the two men. Ironically, Michelle is following in the footsteps of Idina Menzel, who played Michelle's mother on Glee, and memorably sang the role of Florence at a concert version of Chess performed at London's Royal Albert Hall in 2008. I owe so much to Idina. She really inspired me to play this part. Like, I'll cry right now, Michelle says, welling up. When she was in Wicked and I was in Spring Awakening, I waited outside the stage door for her autograph. I just wanted to be her. I found out that she would do yoga on Wednesdays between shows, so I would go to Wednesday yoga just to be near her. Michelle and her co-stars were intimately involved in bringing the new Chess to life, participating in multiple readings and workshops over the past 6 months. A few weeks out from their first rehearsal on September 2nd, things were still in flux. I just read the new version yesterday, says Dwight. It's still evolving. While everyone has contributed to the new version of the show, Strong can't help but single out Michelle, who had the smartest notes for fleshing out Florence. They were really insightful ideas, enriching her, giving her more agency, he says. She's not just functioning as part of a love triangle, but has her own goals and drives. I find myself to be a very strong woman, but playing strong female characters is actually a challenge for me, says Michelle. I find I've always hid behind comedy, and I don't have that here. There's a real sense of vulnerability. I feel naked in so many ways because of that, to just stand in her truth and her power. Chess also may have introduced Michelle to her new favorite song. For as long as she can remember, Don't Rain on My Parade has been her signature number. But while she was mulling her next professional move, the Chess team suggested she listen to Nobody's Side, a powerful rock ballad. After Michelle took their advice, it was checkmate. I was like, this is my new anthem. buddy comedy, from his early stand-up days to his work on such instant classics as Freaks and Geeks and Girls, Judd Apatow has spent a lifetime capturing high hilarity and hoarding the accompanying snapshots and ephemera. In this exclusive excerpt from his visual memoir, Comedy Nerd, where he shares his trove for the first time, Lena Dunham describes the generous guy behind the slapstick. Opening photo, laugh track. Allison Williams, Zosia Mamet, Eileen Landris, Lena Dunham, Adam Driver, and Judd Apatow. Before I ever met Judd Apatow, I was a fan. Not a casual fan, the kind who checks out his films when they come out on demand. Well, it was DVD back then. I was the kind of fan who went to the first midnight showing of Funny People on a Thursday, then went back the next night so I could really hear all the jokes. The kind of fan who bought box sets of Undeclared and Freaks and Geeks in order to study his structure and tone. I was the kind of fan who listened to podcasts and interviews to understand his trajectory, knew the names of his scene-stealing daughters like they were famous football players, and imagined living in a family like the one he and Leslie had created, where they made art together like a modern Von Trapp clan. And while I did blame him for the fact all the hairy, chubby nerds I knew now thought they'd end up with a Katherine Heigl look-alike, I often joked about pulling a reverse Apatow and bagging a box office hunk, a fantasy he'd later allow me to play out to my heart's content on screen. I felt a kinship with him that was about more than the fact that we both came from Long Island Jewish families or could quote our favorite comedians and writers on command. It was about the way his work displayed his vulnerabilities, his fears, his rage, and yet somehow always had a happy ending. I could feel he wrote from a place of love. I wanted to do that too. So when he reached out to me after seeing my independent film, I felt like a child switched at birth who had finally been found by their real parent. I felt like my real life was just beginning. I often joke that I don't know how to write TV. I know how to write Judd Apatow TV. He taught me about format, structure, what works and what doesn't. But he has created his own set of rules in which anything goes as long as it's funny, wise, and true. I wanted to write an episode all set in one room. Great, as long as it made him feel something. I wanted to do a lengthy flashback in a show that had none. That was cool, too. No idea was too strange, no instinct too unorthodox. As long as it was honest, it was kosher. Of course, he gave notes. I do remember one script I rewrote 17 times, but not just for the sake of being heard, like so many producers. He just refuses to rest until the show or film is the best version of the thing it's meant to be. The first time he ever read a script of mine, he emailed, "There's work to do, but you're really, really funny." I wept with joy and took a picture of my own face wet so I could remember it forever. My favorite memories are when Judd and I would write episodes together. We'd usually work late at night after his kids were in bed on the phone. It was like the best game of make-believe with your best friend in your room in fourth grade, just imagining situations and trying to make each other giggle. To this day, there's no better feeling to me than getting Judd to really cackle. He has a fake laugh he does when he's trying to be nice. He may think it's convincing, but it's not. We used to joke that Judd wanted every episode to have either a fist fight or a hand job, and while that's not expressly true, what he wanted and pushed for were moments of messy honesty, moments we hadn't seen on screen before. But the thing he taught me that I have carried more than anything is to let my characters connect, feel pleasure and love. I was cynical about those things in my youth and held some absurd idea that drama was more respectable than comedy, pain more respectable than joy. He once told me, if being funny was easy, then everybody would do it. And he's right. Comedy is the highest writerly mountain to scale. Anyone can tell you a tragic story, but to make you laugh in the process, that's art. From Comedy Nerd, a lifelong obsession in stories and pictures by Judd Apatow, with an introduction by Lena Dunham, to be published October 28th by Random House, a division of Penguin Random House. Copyright 2025 by Judd Apatow and Lena Dunham. Here are some photos from the book. Me, Jason Siegel, my daughter Maud Apatow, Seth Rogen, and Death Krumholtz, David Krumholtz, 2001. A note from Mike Nichols to Leslie about This Is 40. Will Ferrell and Adam McKay always find inappropriately arrogant, unimpressive men to be funny and worthy of scorn, so Anchorman became the satire of office sexism. Their early script was about a group of anchor people on a plane flying to a convention when they crash in the snowy mountains. And it becomes a parody of the movie Alive, with them slowly going mad and trying to eat each other. It was really funny, but insane, so they wrote a new draft. With Maud on the set of Freaks and Geeks. My daughter Iris Apatow and Adam Sandler, 2008. In 11th grade, I started working at my high school radio station, WKWZ Radio. In 1984, I somehow finagled an interview with Steve Allen. This led to interviews with John Candy, Sandra Bernhard, Martin Short, pictured here, and 50 others. It became my comedy college. Anchorman stars Steve Carell, David Koechner, Paul Rudd, and Will Ferrell. Collaborating with John Lovett and his writing staff for the President's speech at the White House Correspondents Association dinner in 2011. I definitely argued to go hard at Donald Trump because my instincts told me he was a dangerous, demented man we did not want in power. When we were putting together the marketing plan for This Is 40, I was offered the opportunity to be a guest editor at Vanity Fair. My magazine editing career was short, but it was definitely a career highlight. Notes from Judd. Leslie Mann came in for a role in The Cable Guy in 1995, and afterwards I said to Ben Stiller, I can't believe the future Mrs. Apatow just walked in the room. Kristen Wiig and Maya Rudolph, Bridesmaids, 2011. We went to Hendersonville, North Carolina, and shot Heavyweights, 1995, at a summer camp. A 16-year-old Kenan Thompson was one of the kids. On The Larry Sanders Show, 1992 to 1998, Jim Carrey said, I'll only do the show if you can guarantee I'll be the funniest person who ever did it. And yes, he was the funniest person who ever did the show. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.